Chapter 86. That the human soul is not transmitted with the semen. It may be shown from the foregoing that the human soul is not transmitted with the semen, as though it were sown by coition, for any principles whatsoever that cannot exercise their operations without the body cannot begin to exist apart from the body, because a thing's being is proportionate to its operation, since everything operates according as it is a being. On the other hand, those principles which exercise their operations without the body are generated apart from the generation of the body. Now the operation of the nutritive and sensitive soul cannot be without the body, as is evident from what has been said, whereas the operation of the intellective soul is not exercised through an organ of the body, as stated above. Consequently, the nutritive and sensitive souls are generated through the generation of the body, but not the intellective soul. Now the transmission of the semen is directed to the generation of the body. Therefore the nutritive and sensitive souls begin to exist through the transmission of the semen, but not the intellective soul. Again, if the human soul began to exist by transmission with the semen, this could only be in two ways. In one way, so that we understand it to be in the semen actually, as though it were accidentally severed from the soul of the generator, just as the semen is severed from the body. This may be seen in annulose animals, that live after being cut in two, and in which there is one soul actually and several in potentiality. For when the body of such an animal is divided, the soul begins to be actually in each living part. In another way, so that we understand the semen to possess a virtue productive of the intellective soul, and thus the intellective soul would be in the semen virtually, but not actually. But the former of these is impossible for two reasons. First, because, since the intellective soul is the most perfect of souls and endowed with the highest power, its proper matter is a body having a great variety of organs, whereby its manifold operations can be accomplished. Consequently, it cannot possibly be actually in the separated semen, since not even the souls of perfect irrational animals are multiplied by division as happens in annulose animals. Secondly, because, since the intellect, which is the proper and principal power of the intellective soul, is not the act of any part of the body, it cannot be accidentally divided through the body being divided, and consequently neither can the intellective soul. The second is also impossible, for the active force in the semen promotes the generation of the animal by transmuting the body, because a material force cannot act otherwise. Now every form that begins to exist through the transmutation of matter has a being dependent on matter, because the transmutation of matter reduces it from potentiality to act, and thus terminates in the actual being of matter, which results from its union with a form. Wherefore, if thereby the being of the form also begins simply, the being of the form will consist merely in its being united to matter, and consequently the form will be dependent on matter for its being. Therefore, if the human soul is brought into being by an active force in the semen, it follows that its being is dependent on matter, like the being of other material forms, whereas the contrary of this has been proved above. Therefore the intellective soul is nowise brought into being through the transmission of the semen. Moreover, every form that is brought into being through the transmutation of matter is brought forth from the potentiality of matter, since the transmutation of matter is its reduction from potentiality to act. Now the intellective soul cannot be brought forth from the potentiality of matter, for it has been shown above that the intellective soul surpasses the whole potentiality of matter, since it has an operation apart from matter, as was proved above. The intellective soul is not brought forth into being through the transmutation of matter, and neither, consequently, by the action of a power residing in the semen. Further, no active force acts beyond its genus. But the intellective soul surpasses the whole genus of bodies, since it has an operation that is raised above all bodies, namely intelligence. Therefore no bodily force can produce an intellective soul. Now whatever action proceeds from a force that is in the semen results from a bodily force, because the formative force acts through the medium of the threefold heat, of fire, of heaven, and of the soul. Therefore the intellective soul cannot be brought into being by a force residing in the semen. Further, it is absurd to state that an intellective substance is either divided through a body being divided, or produced by a bodily virtue. Now the human soul is an intellective substance, as we proved above. Therefore it cannot be said that it is divided through the semen being divided, or that it is brought into being by an active virtue in the semen. Consequently, the human soul nowise begins to exist through the transmission of the semen. Further, if the generation of a thing causes a certain thing to exist, the corruption of the former will cause the latter to cease to exist. Now, the corruption of the body does not cause the soul to cease to exist, for the latter is immortal, as we have proved above. Therefore, is the generation of the body the cause of the soul beginning to exist? But the transmission of the semen is the proper cause of the generation of the body. Therefore, the transmission of the semen is not the cause of the soul being brought into existence. Hereby is excluded the error of Apollinaris and his followers, who said that souls are generated by souls, as bodies by bodies. Chapter 87. That the human soul is brought into being through creation by God. From what has been said, it can be proved that God alone brings the human soul into being. For whatever is brought into being, is either generated per se or accidentally, or is created. Now, the human soul is not generated per se, since it is not composed of matter and form, as shown above. Is it generated accidentally? For, since it is the form of the body, it would be generated through the body being generated, which results from the active force in the semen, and this has been disproved. Since then, the human soul has a beginning of its existence, for it is neither eternal nor exists before the body, as we have shown, it follows that it comes forth into being by creation. Now we have proved that God alone can create, therefore he alone brings forth the human soul into being. Moreover, everything whose substance is not its being has an author of its being, as shown above. Now the human soul is not its own being, for this is peculiar to God alone, as already proved. It has an active cause of its being, but that which has being per se, is also caused per se, whereas that which has not being per se, but only together with some other thing, is caused, not per se, but through this other thing being caused. Thus the form of fire is caused when the fire is made. Now it is proper to the human soul, as compared with other forms, to be subsistent in its own being, and to communicate to the body the being proper to itself. Therefore the human soul has its becoming per se, in contrast to other forms, which have their becoming accidentally, through the making of the composite. But, since the human soul has not matter as part of itself, it cannot be made from something. It remains, therefore, that it is made from nothing, and thus it is created. And seeing that creation is the proper work of God, as we proved above, it follows that it is created immediately by God alone. Further, things belonging to the same genus come into being in the same way, as we proved above. Now the soul belongs to the genus of intellectual substances, and it is inconceivable that these should come into being save by the way of creation. Therefore the human soul comes into being through creation by God. Again, whatsoever is brought into being by an agent, acquires from the latter, either something that is the principle of being in that particular species, or absolute being itself. Now the soul cannot be brought into being in such a way as to acquire something as the principle of its being, as happens in things composed of matter and form, which are generated through acquiring a form in act, because the soul does not contain something in itself by way of principle of its being, for it is a simple substance, as was shown above. Hence it remains that it is not brought into being by an agent except by receiving from it being absolutely. Now being is the proper effect of the first and universal agent, for secondary agents act by impressing the likeness of their forms on the things they make, which likenesses are the forms of the things made. Therefore the soul cannot be brought into being except by the first and universal agent, which is God. Further, the end of a thing corresponds to its principle, for a thing is perfect when it attains its proper principle, whether by likeness, or in any way whatever. Now the end and ultimate perfection of the human soul is to soar above the whole order of creatures and to reach the first principle, which is God. Therefore the proper principle of the soul's origin is God. We also find this implied in Holy Writ, for whereas while speaking of the formation of other animals, it ascribes their souls to other causes, for instance when it says, "Let the waters bring forth the creeping creature with a living soul," and in like manner as to other things, when it comes to man, it indicates the creation of the soul by God, by saying, "God formed man of the slime of the earth, and breathed into his face the breath of life." Hereby is excluded the error of those who hold that souls were created by angels. Chapter 88. Arguments for proving that the human soul is formed from the semen. Nevertheless, is there are some objections to the foregoing, for since man is an animal inasmuch as he has a sensitive soul, and the notion of animal applies univocally to man and other animals, it would seem that man's sensitive soul is of the same genus as the souls of other animals. Now things of the same genus have the same manner of coming into being. Wherefore the sensitive soul of man, as also of other animals, comes into being through a force residing in the semen. But the intellective and sensitive soul are the same in man, as we proved above. Consequently, it would seem that the intellective soul also comes into being through a seminal virtue. Further, as Aristotle teaches, in point of time the fetus is an animal before it is a man. Now, while it is an animal and not a man, it has a sensitive and not an intellective soul, and there can be no doubt that this sensitive soul, even as in other animals, is formed by the active virtue of the semen. But that very same sensitive soul is potentially intellective, just as that animal is potentially a rational animal, unless by chance it be said that the supervening intellective soul is a distinct substance, which has been refuted above. Therefore, seemingly, the substance of the intellective soul is caused by a virtue in the semen. Again, since the soul is the form of the body, it is united to the body and being. Now, things that are one in being are the term of one action and of one agent, for if there were several agents and consequently several actions, effects diverse in being would result. Consequently, the being of soul and body must be the term of the one action of one agent. But it is clear that the body results from the action of a virtue in the semen. Therefore the soul, which is its form, is the effect of the same action, and not of some separate agent. Moreover, man generates his like in species by a virtue residing in the semen after separation. Now, every univocal agent generates its like in species through causing the form of the thing generated, which derives its species from that form. Therefore the human soul, whence man derives his species, is produced by a virtue residing in the semen. Again, Apollinaris argues as follows. Whoever completes a work, company operates with the agent. But if souls are created by God, he completes the generation of children who are sometimes born of adulterers. Therefore God company operates with adulterers, and this seemingly is inadmissible. Again, in a book ascribed to Gregory of Nyssa we find arguments in support of the same statement. This is how he argues. Soul and body together make one thing, and this is one man. If therefore the soul is made before the body, or the body before the soul, one and the same thing will proceed and follow itself, which is seemingly impossible. Therefore body and soul are made at the same time. But the body begins to exist at the separation of the semen. Therefore the soul also is brought into being through the separation of the semen. Again, the operation of an agent would seem to be imperfect, if he does not bring an entire thing into being, but only some part thereof. Therefore if God were to bring the soul into being, while the body was formed by the virtue of the semen, which two things are parts of one, namely man, the operation of both God and the seminal virtue would seem to be imperfect, which is clearly inadmissible. Hence man's soul and body are produced by one and the same cause. Now, it is clear that man's body is produced by the virtue of the semen. Therefore the soul is also. Again, in everything generated from seed, all the parts of the thing generated are together virtually contained in the seed, though they appear not actually. Thus in wheat or any other seed we see that the grass with stem, stalks, fruit, and beard are virtually contained in the original seed. Afterwards the seed spreads forth and by a kind of natural consequence reaches perfection without taking to itself anything outside itself. Now it is clear that the soul is part of man. Therefore the human seed contains virtually the human soul, and this does not take its origin from any external principle. Moreover, things that have the same process and term must have the same principle of origin. Now in the generation of a man we find the same process and term in the body as in the soul, for the soul's operations become more and more manifest, as the members are developed in shape and size. Thus the operation of the nutritive soul is apparent at first, afterwards, the operation of the sensitive soul, and lastly, the body being fully developed, the operation of the intellective soul. Therefore the body and soul have the same principle, but the principle of origin in the body is through the separation of the semen. Therefore the same is the principle of the soul's origin. Again, that which is conformed to a thing, is fashioned by the action of the thing to which it is conformed. For instance, the wax that is conformed to the seal, receives this conformity from the impression of the seal. Now it is evident that the body of a man or of any animal is conformed to its own soul, because its organs are so arranged as required by the soul's operations to be exercised by them. Therefore the body is formed by the action of the soul. Wherefore Aristotle says to De Anima, that the soul is the efficient cause of the body. But this would not be so were not the soul in the semen, because the body is fashioned by the power that is in the semen. Therefore the human soul is in the semen and consequently takes its origin from the separation of the semen. Again, nothing lives except by a soul. Now the semen is living, is proved in three ways. First, because it is severed from a living being. Secondly, because the semen gives signs of vital heat and vital operations, which are indications of a living thing. Thirdly, because the seeds of plants when put into the soil, unless they had life in themselves, could not gather heat from the soil, which is inanimate, so as to live. Therefore the soul is in the semen and consequently, it originates with the severing of the semen. Moreover, if the soul were not before the body, as we have proved, and did not begin to be at the severance of the semen, it follows that the body is formed first, and the newly created soul infused into the body afterwards. Now, were this true, it would further follow that the soul is for the sake of the body, because that which is on another's account is found to come after it. Even so clothes are made for man. But this is false, since on the contrary the body is for the soul's sake, since the end is always of greater excellence. We must therefore conclude that the soul originates together with the severance of the semen. Chapter 89. Solution of the foregoing arguments. For the easier solution of the foregoing arguments, we must first of all set down certain points, in order to explain the order and process of the generation of man, as well as of animals in general. In the first place then it must be observed that the opinion of those is false who say that the vital operations that appear in the embryo before its ultimate completion, do not proceed from a soul or soul's power, existing therein, but from the soul of the mother. For if this were true, the embryo will no longer be an animal, since every animal consists of soul and body. Moreover, vital operations do not proceed from an extrinsic active principle, but from an internal force, and it is in this that inanimate things differ from the living, to which it properly belongs to move themselves. Because that which is nourished assimilates nourishment, wherefore in the subject nourished there must needs be an active nutritive power, since the agent produces its like. And much more evident is this in the operation of the senses, because to see and to hear are competent to a person through some faculty existing in him and not in another. Wherefore if the embryo is observed to be nourished and even to sense before its final development, that cannot be ascribed to the soul of the mother. And yet it cannot be said that the soul, as to its complete essence, is in the semen from the very beginning, and that the operations of the soul are not apparent on account of the lack of organs. For, since the soul is united to the body as its form, it is not united to a body other than one of which it is properly the act. Now the soul is the act of an organic body. Consequently the soul is not actually in the semen before the organization of the body, but only potentially or virtually. Wherefore Aristotle says, that seed and fruit are potentially living as long as they put aside, i.e. are without, the soul. Yet the thing of which the soul is the act, is potentially living, but is not without a soul. It would also follow, if the soul were in the semen from the beginning, that the generation of an animal would be by the mere severance, as happens in annulose animals, where two are made from one. For if the semen were animated as soon as severed, it would at once have a substantial form. Now every substantial generation proceeds, and does not follow, the substantial form. And if any changes follow the substantial form, they are directed, not to the being but to the well-being of the thing generated. Accordingly the generation of the animal would be completed in the mere severance of the semen, and all subsequent changes would have nothing to do with generation. Even more absurd would this be if applied to the rational soul, both because it cannot possibly be divided according to the division of the body, so that it be possible for it to be in the semen after severance, and because it would follow that whenever pollution occurs without conception taking place, rational souls would nevertheless be multiplied. Nor can it be asserted, as some say, that although from the moment of severance the soul is not in the semen actually but virtually, on account of the lack of organs, yet this very virtue of the semen, which is a body capable of receiving organs though it has them not actually, is proportionately a potential but not an actual soul to the semen, and that, since the life of a plant requires fewer organs than the life of an animal, when first the semen is sufficiently prepared for plant life, this same virtue of the semen becomes a vegetative soul, and then, when the organs have been yet more perfected and multiplied, the same virtue advances to the state of a sensitive soul, and further still, the form of the organs being perfected, the same soul becomes rational, not indeed by the action of this seminal virtue, but by the action of an external agent, for which reason they imagine Aristotle to have said that the intellect is from without, for according to this opinion it would follow that the same identical virtue is at one time a purely vegetative soul, and afterwards a sensitive soul, so that the substantial form itself would be perfected more and more by stages. It would also follow that the substantial form would be brought from potentiality to act not at once but by degrees. And again, that generation, like alteration, is a continuous movement. All of which things are impossible in nature. A conclusion still more inadmissible would follow, namely that the rational soul is mortal, for nothing that accrues as a form to that which is corruptible makes it naturally incorruptible, else a corruptible thing would be changed into an incorruptible one, which is impossible, since they differ in genus, as stated in 10 Metaphysics. Now the substance of the sensitive soul, since in the aforesaid process it is stated to be generated accidentally by the generated body, must needs be corruptible at the corruption of the body. If therefore the same soul becomes rational by a light introduced within it, which light is related to it as a form, for the sensitive is potentially intellective, it follows of necessity that the rational soul perishes when the body perishes. And this is impossible, as we proved above, as the Catholic faith teaches. Therefore the self-same virtue which is severed together with the semen and is called the formative virtue, is not the soul, nor does it become the soul in the process of generation, but, since it is based, as on its proper subject, on the vital spirit contained in the frothy semen, it causes the formation of the body in so far as it operates by virtue of the father soul, to whom generation is ascribed as the principal agent, and not by virtue of the soul of the person conceived. Even after the soul is in that person, for the subject conceived does not generate itself, but is generated by the father. This is clear to anyone who considers each power of the soul separately, for it cannot be ascribed to the soul of the embryo by reason of the generative power, not only because the generative power does not exercise its operation until the work is completed of the nutritive and augmentative powers which are its auxiliaries, since to generate belongs to that which is perfect, but also because the work of the generative power is directed, not to the perfection of the individual, but to the preservation of the species. Nor again can it be ascribed to the nutritive power, the work of which is to assimilate nourishment to the subject nourished, which is not apparent here, since in the process of formation the nourishment is not assimilated to something already existing, but is advanced to a more perfect form and more approaching to a likeness to the father. Likewise neither can it be ascribed to the augmentative power, since it belongs to this power to cause a change, not of form, but of quantity. As to the sensitive and intellective part, it is clear that it has no operation appropriate to such a formation. It remains then that the formation of the body, especially as regards the foremost and principal parts, is not from the form of the subject generated, nor from a formative power acting by virtue of that form, but from a formative power acting by virtue of the generative soul of the father, the work of which soul is to produce the specific like of the generator. Accordingly this formative power remains the same in the aforesaid spirit from the beginning of the formation until the end. Yet the species of the subject formed remains not the same, because at first it has the form of semen, afterwards of blood, and so onwards until it arrives at its final complement. For although the generation of simple bodies does not proceed in order, since each of them has an immediate form of primary matter, in the generation of other bodies, There must be an order in the generations, by reason of the many intermediate forms between the first elemental form and the final form, which is the term of generation, wherefore there are a number of generations and corruptions following one another. Nor is it unreasonable if one of the intermediates be generated and then at once interrupted, because the intermediate stages have not a complete species but are on the way to a species, hence they are generated, not that they may remain, but that the final term of generation may be reached through them. Nor need we wonder if the transmutation of generation be not throughout continuous, and that there are many intermediate generations, for this happens also in alteration and growth, since neither alteration nor growth is continuous throughout, but only local movement is truly continuous, as we find proved in innate physic. Accordingly, the more noble a form is and the further removed it is from the elemental form, the more numerous must needs be the intermediate forms, through which the ultimate form is reached by degrees, and consequently the more numerous will be the intermediate generations. Wherefore in the generation of an animal or a man in which the form is most perfect, there are many intermediate forms and generations, and consequently corruptions, since the generation of one is the corruption of another. Therefore the vegetative soul, which comes first, when the embryo lives the life of a plant, is corrupted, and is succeeded by a more perfect soul which is both nutritive and sensitive, and then the embryo lives an animal life, and when this is corrupted it is succeeded by the rational soul introduced from without, although the preceding souls were produced by the virtue in the semen. Keeping these points before the mind, it is easy to answer the objections. For in reply to the first objection, where it is stated that the sensitive soul must have the same manner of origin in man and in irrational animals, because animal is predicated of both univocally, we say that this is not necessary, because although the sensitive souls in man and dumb animals agree generically, they differ specifically, like the things of which they are the forms. For just as the animal that is a man differs specifically from other animals in the point of being rational, so the sensitive soul of man differs specifically from the sensitive soul of a dumb animal in this, that it is also intellective. Wherefore the sensitive soul in the dumb animal has no more than the sensitive faculty, and consequently neither its being nor its operation is raised above the body, and so it must needs be generated together with the body, and perish when the body perishes. On the other hand, the sensitive soul in a man, through having besides the sensitive nature an intellective power, in consequence of which it follows that it is raised above the body both in being and in operation, is neither generated through the generation of the body, nor perishes through the body's corruption. Hence the different manner of origin in the aforesaid souls is not on the part of the sensitive faculty whence the generic nature is taken, but on the part of the intellective faculty, whence the specific difference is derived. Therefore we can conclude a difference not of genus but only of species. When it is objected in the second place that the thing conceived is an animal before a man, this does not prove that the rational soul is transmitted together with the semen, because the sensitive soul whereby it was an animal does not remain, but is succeeded by a soul that is both sensitive and intellective, whereby it is at the same time both animal and man, as explained above. The statement in the third objection, that the actions of different agents do not terminate in one thing made, must be understood as referring to different agents of which one is not ordered to the other. For if they be ordered the one to the other, they must have one effect, for the first active cause acts on the effect of the secondary active cause more intimately than does the secondary cause. Hence we find that an effect produced by a principal agent through an instrument is more properly ascribed to the principal agent than to the instrument. Now it happens sometimes that the action of the principal agent attains to something in the effect produced, to which the action of the instrument does not attain. Thus the vegetative power produces the species of flesh, which the heat of fire that is its instrument cannot produce, although it acts dispositively thereto by dissolving and consuming. Since then every active force of nature is compared to God as an instrument is compared to the first and principal agent, nothing hinders the action of nature, in one and the same subject generated which is a man, from terminating in a part of man and not in the whole, which is the effect of God's action. Accordingly the human body is fashioned at the same time both by the power of God as the principal and first agent, and by the power of the semen as secondary agent. But God's action produces the human soul, which the seminal power cannot produce, but to which it disposes. Hence the reply to the fourth objection is clear, because a man begets his like in species, insofar as the seminal virtue in him operates dispositively towards the ultimate form whence man derives his species. That God should company operate with adulterers in the action of nature involves no contradiction, for it is not the nature but the will that is evil in adulterers, and the action which proceeds from their seminal virtue is natural and not voluntary. Wherefore it is not unreasonable that God company operate in their action by giving it its ultimate perfection. As to the sixth objection, it is clear that the conclusion does not necessarily follow, for even if we grant that man's body is fashioned before the soul is created, or vice versa, it does not follow that the self-same man precedes himself, since a man is not his body nor his soul, but it follows that some part of him precedes the other. In this there is nothing unreasonable, because matter precedes form in point of time. Matter, that is to say, considered as being in potentiality to form, but not as actually perfected by a form, for as such it is simultaneous with the form. Accordingly the human body, considered as in potentiality to the soul, and as not yet having a soul, precedes the soul in point of time, but then it is human, not actually, but only potentially. On the other hand, when it is human actually, as being perfected by the human soul, it neither precedes nor follows the soul, but is simultaneous with it. Nor again does it follow, if the soul is not produced by the seminal virtue, but only the body, that the operation both of God and of nature is imperfect, as the seventh argument inferred, because both body and soul are made by the power of God, although the fashioning of the body is from him by means of the natural virtue in the semen, whereas he produces the soul immediately. Neither does it follow that the action of the seminal virtue is imperfect, since it fulfills the purpose for which it is intended. It must also be noted that the seed contains virtually whatever does not surpass a corporeal virtue, for instance the grass with the stem, stalks, and so forth, whence we cannot conclude that the part of man which surpasses the whole corporeal virtue is contained virtually in the seed, as the eighth argument inferred. That the operations of the soul seem to develop in the process of human generation, according as the parts of the body develop, does not prove that the human soul and body have the same principle, as the ninth argument suggested, but it proves that the disposition of the body's parts is necessary for the soul's operation. The statement of the tenth objection, that the body is conformed to the soul, and that for this reason the soul fashions a body like to itself, is partly true and partly false. For if it be understood of the soul of the begetter, the statement is true, whereas it is false if it be referred to the soul of the begotten, because the body is not formed by the virtue of the soul of the begotten, as regards the body's foremost and principal parts, but by the virtue of the soul of the begetter, as we proved above. For all matter is similarly configured to its form, and yet this configuration results not from the action of the subject generated, but from the action of the generator. As to the 11th objection about the life of the semen at the beginning of its severance, it is clear from what has been said that it is not living except potentially, wherefore it has a soul then not actually but virtually. In the process of generation it has a vegetative and a sensitive soul by the virtue of the semen, which do not remain but pass away when the rational soul takes their place. Nor again, if the fashioning of the body precedes the human soul, does it follow that the soul is for the sake of the body, as the 12th objection inferred. For one thing is for another's sake in two ways. First, for the sake of its operation, or preservation, or any like thing consequent upon being, and the like are posterior to the thing for the sake of which they are, thus clothes are for man, and tools for the workman. Secondly, a thing is for another's sake, i.e., for the sake of its being. And thus a thing which is for the sake of another precedes the latter in the order of time, but follows it in the order of nature. It is in this way that the body is for the sake of the soul, just as all matter is for the sake of a form. It would be otherwise if from soul and body there resulted a thing that is not one in being, as those assert who deny that the soul is the form of the body. Chapter 90. That an intellectual substance is united as a form to no other than the human body. Since it has been proved that a certain intellectual substance, the human soul to wit, is united to a body as its form, it remains for us to ask whether any intellectual substance can be united as form to any other body. Indeed, as regards heavenly bodies, we have shown above was Aristotle's opinion as to their being animated with an intellective soul, and that Augustine leaves the question unsolved. Wherefore the present inquiry must be confined to elemental bodies. That an intellectual substance is not united as form to any elemental body save that of man is evidently clear. For were it united to some other, it would be united either to a mixed or to a simple body. But it cannot be united to a mixed body, because that body, in respect of its genus, would have to surpass other mixed bodies in evenness of temperament, since we see that mixed bodies have formed so much the more noble, the nearer they approach to an even temperament. And so if that which has a most noble form, such as an intellectual substance, be a mixed body, it must have a most even temperament. For this reason we find that a soft flesh and a delicate touch are signs of a keen understanding. Now the most even temperament is that of the human body. Consequently, if an intellectual substance be united to a mixed body, the latter must have the same nature as the human body. Moreover, its form would be of the same nature as the human soul, if it were an intellectual substance. Therefore, there would be no specific difference between that animal and man. Again, neither can an intellectual substance be united as form to a simple body, such as air, water, fire, or earth. Because each of these bodies is like in the whole and in the parts, since a part of air has the same nature and species as the whole air, for it has the same movement, and the same applies to the others. Now like movers have like forms. Accordingly, if any part of any one of the aforesaid bodies, air for instance, be animated with an intellectual soul, for the same reason the whole air and all its parts will be animated. But this is seen clearly to be false, because there is no sign of vital operations in the parts of the air or of other simple bodies. Therefore an intellectual substance is not united as form to any part of the air or of similar bodies. Again, if an intellectual substance be united as form to one of the simple bodies, it will have either an intellect only, or it will have other powers, for instance those which belong to the sensitive or to the nutritive part, as in man. If it have the intellect only, there is no use in its being united to the body. For every form of a body exercises a proper operation through the body. And the intellect has no operation pertaining to the body, except in so far as it moves the body, because understanding is not an operation that can be exercised by an organ of the body, nor is willing, for the same reason. Again, the movements of the elements are from natural movers, namely their generators, and they move not themselves. Wherefore it does not follow that they are animated because they have movement. If, on the other hand, the intellectual substance, which is supposed to be united to an element or to a part thereof, have other parts of the soul, since these parts are parts of certain organs, it follows that we shall find diversity of organs in the body of the element. But this is inconsistent with its simplicity. Therefore an intellectual substance cannot be united as form to an element or to a part thereof. Moreover, the nearer a body is to primary matter, the less noble it is, according as it is more in potentiality and less in complete actuality. Now the elements are nearer than mixed bodies to primary matter, since they are the proximate matter of mixed bodies. Consequently the elemental bodies are less noble than mixed bodies as to their species. Wherefore, since the more noble bodies have more noble forms, it is impossible that the noblest form of all, which is the intellective soul, be united to the bodies of the elements. Again, if the elemental bodies or any parts thereof were animated by the noblest kind of soul, which is the intellective soul, it would follow that the more akin a body is to the elements, the nearer it approaches to life. Now this does not appear to be the case, but rather the contrary, for plants have less of life than animals, and yet they are more akin to earth, while minerals, which are still more akin, have no life at all. Therefore an intellectual substance is not united as form to an element or to a part thereof. Further, exceeding contrariety is destructive of life in all corruptible movers, for excessive heat or cold, wet or dryness, are fatal to animals and plants. Now these contraries exceed especially in the elemental bodies. Therefore life cannot possibly be in them. Therefore it is impossible for an intellectual substance to be united to them as their form. Moreover, although the elements are incorruptible as a whole, each of their parts is corruptible as having contrariety. If, therefore, some parts of the elements have cognitive substances united to them, it seems that the power of discerning corruptives should especially be ascribed to them. Now this is the sense of touch, which discriminates between hot and cold and like contraries, and for this very reason it is in all animals, as though it were necessary for preservation from corruption. But this sense cannot possibly be in a simple body, since the organ of touch needs to have contraries not actually but potentially, and this is the case only in mixed and tempered bodies. Therefore it is not possible that any parts of the elements be animated with an intellective soul. Again, every living body has some kind of local movement proceeding from its soul, for the heavenly bodies, if indeed they be animated, have a circular movement. Perfect animals a progressive movement, shellfish a movement of expansion and contraction, plants a movement of increase and decrease, all of which are kinds of local movement. Whereas in the elements there is no sign of movement proceeding from a soul, but only such as is natural. Therefore they are not living bodies. If, however, it be said that although an intellectual substance be not united as a form to an elemental body or part thereof, yet it is united thereto as its mover, the former is impossible if applied to the air. For since a part of the air has no bounds of its own, no determinate part of the air can have its own proper movement, on account of which an intellectual substance be united to it. Moreover, if an intellectual substance be naturally united to a body as a mover to its proper movable, the motive power of that substance must be confined to the movable body to which it is naturally united, since the power of every proper mover does not, in moving, go beyond its proper movable. Now it seems absurd to say that the power of an intellectual substance does not, in moving, exceed a determinate part of an element, or some mixed body. Therefore seemingly it must not be said that an intellectual substance is naturally united to an elemental body as its mover, unless it be united thereto also as its form. Again, the movement of an elemental body can proceed from other principles besides an intellectual substance. Wherefore this movement is not a sufficient reason for intellectual substances to be naturally united to elemental bodies. Hereby is excluded the opinion of Apuleius and certain Platonists, who asserted that the demons are animals with an aerial body, a rational mind, passive in soul, and eternal in duration, and of certain heathens who held the elements to be animated, wherefore they offered them divine worship. Again, the opinion is refuted of those who said that angels and demons have bodies naturally united to them, which respectively partake of the nature of the higher or lower elements.